Welcome to another episode of More Happy Life, the podcast that will teach you how to trigger upward spirals of health and happiness in your life. I'm Andy Proctor, a happiness activist whose goal is to make your life more happy with science-backed strategies and powerful interviews. If you enjoy this episode, share it and let me know by tapping the stars in the reviews. Welcome back to another episode of More Happy Life. This is your host, Andy Proctor, and today we have an amazing guest for this episode that I'm excited to introduce you to. His name is Eric Karpinski. He has been on the cutting edge of bringing positive psychology tools to the workplace for over 10 years with clients that include Intel, Facebook, IBM, T-Mobile, Genentech, and many others. He is a key member of Sean Aker's Good Think team, trained as a scientist at Brown University, and has an MBA from the Wharton School of Business as well. McGraw-Hill is publishing his new book, Put Happiness to Work, which we talk about in this interview, in this episode. It's amazing. And this book has been endorsed by amazing people such as Dan Pink and Adam Grant. The foreword was actually written by Sean Aker, who's one of the amazing happiness activists out there, who is one of my happiness heroes as well. So I hope you take some time to listen to this episode today. It's amazing. We go through some really great things, not just about bringing happiness to the workplace, but also, you know, why happiness is so important for us in our daily life, how we can activate happiness within, how we can have more relaxed, satisfied, content work, how we can really, bring our best relationships or build our best relationships at work as well, which is so huge. So I hope you listen to this one today. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy this episode. Eric, thank you so much for being on the show today. I'm so excited to be able to talk about some of these awesome things. I always love having other kind of happiness activists, well-being activists type of people on my show, obviously the More Happy Life podcast. So cool to have you tonight.
Really glad to be here, Andy. And it's just great to be happiness activists. Or there's more of us coming, but it sure is Nice to have colleagues out there trying to make this happen. Share the great research that's out there.
Absolutely. So, and speaking of, kind of your story and the great research is out there. So, tell me and tell the listeners too, what's kind of your, I love hearing these stories. Like, what is your happiness kind of superhero origin story? Like what drew you into this field?
Well, I love that question. Since I was a little kid, I wanted to be happy. Like the vast majority of us, right? But as I was asking as a middle school, high schooler, like, all right, so how do I be happy? The world told me really clearly, Eric, if you want to be happy, you got to be successful. And in order to be successful, you have to work hard, right? And so this is relatively common thing, right? TV, teachers, parents, all these people are telling you, well, you got to be successful. Once you're successful, then you'll make lots of money. You'll be able to do the things you want to do, and you'll be able to buy the things you want. I bought into that whole line and sinker. And so I did. I did all the things I was supposed to do, right? What does success mean? For a high schooler, it means going to college, first of all. And then I got into a group of people that said, you need to go into the best college you can, right? The Ivy League. What are you going to do? So I worked really hard, and absolutely I got lucky and managed to get a biochemistry degree from Brown. And I went back and got an MBA from Wharton. Awesome. Those are great markers of success. I was able to also land like really sought after jobs in management consulting and venture capital. By the time I was 35, I was making lots of money, bought a nice house in San Diego. I was married. I had two kids. I should have been over the moon happy because I was more successful than I ever expected to be. And instead, I was the exact opposite. The stress of this need to always get that next promotion and always get that next raise and always needing success to try to drive happiness. And every time getting stepped into a sort of a more elite group, at some point it breaks. And the stress sort of, for me, caused tons of anxiety. That anxiety turned into insomnia. And as you know, when you don't sleep well for night after night after night, it starts making your emotions really labile. I started suffering from depression and having to see therapists and taking Paxil. And, you know, I sort of popped my head out. And at that point, I was like, I wanted to succeed my way to happiness, right? That's what I was sold.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. And in fact, it took me exactly the opposite place, depression and sadness. And so I said, well, what am I doing? This isn't working. I need to stop. I need to get off this treadmill. Right. And I was trained as a scientist, as I said. So I said, well, what does research say about it? And this was, positive psychology was still pretty new, but there were some really great papers that were out there in, you know, 2005, 2006, 2007. I started reading them, and I started getting an understanding for what positive psychology and neuroscience and organizational psychology was saying and what the research was saying. And it said, look, we can be happy. And here's a lot of different things, a lot of different tools and ways we can do it. And guess what? There's all these benefits if we can find more positive emotions in our life. And I just, when I started reading it, I decided I need to be on the forefront of sharing this information with people, because nobody's talking about it out there, you know, in the mid 2000, you know,
yeah.
mid-2000s. And so I was like, all right, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go do that. I'm going to, become a happiness superhero. you know, I've never considered myself that, but it's certainly, I want to be out there changing it. And so for the last 10 years, I've been able to work with organizations across the spectrum. Big companies like Facebook and IBM and Intel, and then little small companies and school districts and hospitals and all these different groups, figuring out how do we practically translate all that great research into things that each of us can do. And that was hugely important. And then I wrote a book. I'm just publishing right now about happiness specifically at work. And 80% of that book is good for anyone that wants to be happier at work and wants to bring their colleagues and coworkers along.
That's so beautiful. And, you know, Eric, I officially dub you a happiness superhero. So you,
yes, I'm going to do one of those like superhero landings, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You get a cape and everything. So
my son loves the Marvel movies, watched them all over and over and over. And I just need a big H on it, right? And
that's right. Yeah, exactly. Yep. That's I can hear the theme music right now. So that's amazing. I really do love hearing people's stories. It's so cool. And especially around, you know, how people got into positive psychology and happiness, the science of happiness. I mean, everybody who I talk to who's you know, in some way involved in this field or in this area, they have that story where they just like see the light, you know, and they're just like, wait a second, what is going on? You know, this is either it's like, I am called to this, or it's like that moment where you're just like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm taking Paxil. I'm not sleeping. I'm just like, this is not the life that I signed up for. You know? And, so thank you for kind of getting vulnerable and sharing a little bit about that. So, sure. And you know, you're an expert at getting happiness, the science of happiness into the workplace. So I want to kind of, you know, point this out to the listeners out there who are like managers, employers, you know, HR people, whatever, like who are thinking, wait a second, like, why should I care about this? What's the big deal?
Yeah. Well, there's really two main reasons. One, it's the right thing to do. Right?
Yeah, right.
If we're going to be good managers, we have to care about our people. We have to care about their well-being. We have to care about their happiness. So it's the right thing to do for anyone we interact with. How can we help people live a better life, right? And part of it is providing a salary, absolutely. But that's not enough anymore. We need to do more. So there's kind of the let's do right by other people aspect. And then the second part, and this is the part that's great because it really helps everybody get aligned, is that certain types of happiness, certain positive emotions really drive work engagement. And work engagement is this idea, and this Gallup's been doing research on this for 20 years. And they did a pivotal study back in, I think in 2001, that shows when your people are engaged, when you've got teams that are engaged, it increases your productivity, your profitability, your customer service, your safety, all of the things that are important outcomes can be helped if you're more engaged. The problem is we've been trying to increase engagement for 20 years, but particularly the last 10 years. And if you look at Gallup's index, it stayed stubbornly within 30, like around 30%, a few percentage up, a few percentage down for 20 years. So we're not landing. We're not doing this right. And you know, the reason I think is pretty clear. Because when leaders talk about engagement, they talk about exactly what I said, the benefits to the organization, productivity and profitability. Or managers will often talk about it, well, if I have an engaged team, then they're going to be loyal and committed and put in discretionary effort. Well, when individual contributors hear managers and leaders talking about that, they're like, well, that's great for you and great for the organization, I guess. But it just sounds like you're asking me to work harder without paying me more money, without getting anything from me, right? It's not motivating.
Yeah.
People just don't care about their engagement, but they do care deeply about their happiness. And what's really interesting is when people are engaged, when we look at people who are engaged in their work, they often feel inspired. They often feel enthusiastic and proud of what they're doing. They feel like they belong and what they're doing is meaningful, that it matters. In a word, these people feel, when they're engaged, they feel activated happiness. So if we can change as leaders, as employers, if we can change how we think and talk about engagement, instead of saying, hey, you guys should be engaged because it's better for us, instead of focusing on the outcomes, we should really focus on, hey, we want you to be happy because A, it's the right thing to do, and because we know that if we help you all be happy, and particularly certain types of happiness that we can talk about, the breakdown, that's going to help everybody pull in the same direction. Because if they feel these activated positive emotions, they're going to be more engaged. And then everybody's going to start pulling in the same direction. You're aligned with the incentives, right? We want to be happy. So let's do things that help us be happy. And as leaders, we want you to be engaged because there's so many benefits to the organization. Let's focus on this place where the two overlap, where that Venn diagram really overlaps and says, these emotions, these positive emotions really drive engagement, because then we're in a place that we can overcome difficult challenges and everybody wins because we're feeling good along the way.
Yeah, I love that. So what you're saying is, you know, because I think a lot of times like employers, they focus on, okay, if I find an employees who are just naturally engaged in this, you know, whatever the role is, then the happiness comes. But what you're saying, I mean, you're saying that too, but what you're also saying is when you help them to be happier, when you bring happiness into the workplace, then naturally they're just going to be engaged.
Exactly. But it's got to be certain types of emotions and happiness, right?
Yeah.
We can, if we think about when I talk about happiness, I really talk about the experience of all positive emotions. So that includes things like feeling satisfied and feeling relaxed and feeling comfortable, but it also, which are kind of lower energy positive emotions, but it also includes feeling enthusiastic, feeling fulfilled, feeling like you're valued, feeling like you belong. And it's those second set of emotions, of positive emotions, that really overlap and drive engagement. It's easy to be, you know, the contentment and satisfied. It's kind of what I call rest and digest type of positive emotions. Hey, things are pretty good. I don't have to rock the boat. I don't have to make a lot of changes. I'm content. Things are fine, right? And that's okay. Mm-hmm. We like feeling that,
right?
But it's not terribly motivating. It's not like, oh, I've got to make some change. I've got to make things better. Whereas when you feel like you're part of a team that's doing something important, when you feel like you're valued and that you're affirmed as part of that team, when you feel like, you know, that what you're doing is meaningful, that helps you drive forward. And so the seven strategies in the book are all about how do we increase those activated positive emotions to really help people both feel good and be more engaged.
Activated positive emotion. That's really, I love that. It's like fulfilled, belonging, valued, and affirmed, right? I think it feels like it goes right in line with, I think it was the Apollo study or something at Google, where they talked about, you know, the number one predictor of the successful team was this like concept of psychological safety, right? Which is, you know, I mean,
Project Aristotle.
Aristotle. Okay. Not yet. Not Apollo. Yeah, that's great.
You nailed it, right? I mean, they did this study, Google did, that talks about all of that. They looked at all of the specific attributes of each person, their intelligence, their creativity, their drive, their education levels. Mm. And they realized, and of course, Google knows how to do data,
right? Yeah.
They know how to do searching and find patterns. And they realized that none of those individual traits mattered to the success of the team. But one thing that did was that everyone felt socially connected, and that they felt safe sharing ideas. That's the psychological safety that you're talking about is all about, hey, do I feel like I can contribute? Am I opinions welcomed? And that drives super high performance. That's what, you know, of course, you know, you're talking about a lot of high performers at Google to start with. They sort of the best and the brightest. Once you're in that place, what really mattered was, hey, do people get along? Are they creating a space that people can share ideas? I love that. It's such a great study.
It really is. It's a cool one to refer back to, and just to remind myself too, you know. And so, you know, speaking of this concept of like belonging and feeling valued, this like, you know, psychological safety within the workplace. So I just recently told you that I was accepted this PhD program to study adult friendship and how that impacts our health. Which is super exciting. And
congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And
big step.
Yeah. Right. And so it has a big impact on our happiness and our health, and specifically at work too, you know, like this whole, I think it was Gallup as well that said, you know, they talked about like one of the big predictors of whether people stay in their job is if they have a friend. Right. And, so I'd love to have you, or I'd love to learn from you and have you share with the listeners about this whole concept of making friends at work. And, you know, cause you know, within positive psychology, you know, relationships is a big deal. I mean, you know, the R of the PERMA. And, so, you know, do you think that this is important, and like what are the challenges and, kind of some of the impacts that you see from, the standpoint of this like concept of happiness at work, like this activated happiness.
Yeah. Yeah. Our relationships, I mean, one of the seven strategies is all about how do we create connection at work? Because we know that happiness is the number one driver. Sorry, relationships, strong relationships is the number one driver of happiness. If you look at the 10% of the quote unquote happiest people, people living the good life. Ed Diener and Seligman looked at the study, and the one thing that was common to all of the happiest decile was the strength of their relationships. If you look at the Harvard Men's Study that tracked, first of all, I think it was like 400 men from Harvard and another 600 men that were of a similar age in just the local communities in Boston. They tracked them for their entire lives, all the way through the wars, all the way through all of, you know, the change of the century. And they found that the one thing that was common, the one thing that helped people survive better and be more successful was the strength of those relationships. And they didn't have to, it doesn't have to be like they had to all be extroverted, amazing, like have 1,000 friends. They just needed several people that they could lean into when they needed, and that they were leaned on when their friends needed them, or their, you know, their partners, whoever it was. We need as humans strong relationships really to thrive and to largely to survive.
Totally.
And so I think there's no question that happiness, I mean, that these strong relationships are a driver of happiness, and they're definitely a driver of engagement as well. Without without knowing, without connecting with people, the Project Aristotle data, absolutely. If you look at Gallup, like you said, one of their questions is, do you have a best friend at work? I know IBM Kinexa is another group that measures a lot of engagement, and feeling like someone's a part of a team is one of their top 10 engagement drivers. We need other people. We need support to get our work done, to generate ideas, to get through peaks in our workflow, to overcome problems. So those relationships are centrally important. And I think the pandemic has really hurt a lot of us.
Yeah.
Caused so much loneliness and isolation. And besides our people that live in our household, people at work are largely some of the only people we're interacting with regularly.
Right.
So there's a lot of things I've been speaking a lot about what are things we can do to, because people are so lonely and isolated and the masking and the social distance all is causing more problems. Yes, we've got these vaccines. Yes, we're hoping by the summer we might start getting back to some kind of getting back to more social engagement and those types of things. But we can't keep waiting. We've been waiting for a year for things to get better and they haven't. So we need to do things now. And, you know, I'm happy to go into some of the specifics if you...
I would love you to. Actually, that was going to be my next question is, you know, what does that look like? You know, what could that look like?
Yeah. So I guess there's two places I'd love to start. One is, let's talk about a couple of personal habits that can help us feel more connected to others. Mm-hmm. One is, you know, we've talked about gratitude exercises since the beginning of positive psychology. But specifically sitting down and writing, thinking of three people that you appreciate and what specifically you appreciate about them. So like if you've already got a gratitude practice, great. Let's just make it explicitly about people. Who are the people in your life and what do you appreciate about them? So just do that. Like pick three people, take 5 minutes each day, write about it. Helps. Isn't that a second habit, which I love, is called, I call it connection meditation. It comes from the traditional loving kindness meditation. Mm. I don't know if you've spent any time with it, but it's a really simple meditation where you simply you start with someone that is really easy for you to love. Maybe it's a grandparent, maybe it's a niece or a nephew, maybe it's someone who is really good to you, a benefactor, and just envision them and send them good wishes. Like, may you be happy. May you be healthy. May you live with ease. Whatever words matter to you, right? They shouldn't be generic words. They should be words that you use. And open yourself to the love you feel for that person, right? And then once you do that for a round or two of sort of wishing them, then you take that sort of love that you've sort of built up and you bring it to someone else. Maybe it's your partner or someone you feel close to, but you also can also be conflicted, right? You can have some conflict with them and you bring it to them. And that's usually pretty easy too, right? Bring them the love and then the conflict comes up just, okay, but I love them too. And I want them to be well. I want them to be happy. And then you move it to someone you don't know that well or someone at work that maybe you want to get to know better. What's really cool as you, and what it does is it enables you to feel sort of this love and connection with new people. And the more you practice this, the more easy it is to connect. And in fact, Barbara Fredrickson at UNC and a group at Stanford has done a lot of studies saying that by doing this for, you know, a few weeks, it really helps build our empathy. It helps us be open to more connection when it happens, like when we get interact with people. And it really brings, it really helps us connect better with people. It's something I recommend for people that feel like they don't have the care for their colleagues or whatever.
Yeah.
Practice this exercise. It can help, you know? So anyway.
Yeah, that's a powerful one. I love that one.
Yeah. And on an individual, and by the way, it's also a lot easier to learn to stay with than mindfulness. Barbara Fredrickson did a comparison and people that were doing this loving kindness meditation, because it felt so good in the moment, they usually stick with it a lot longer than they would with mindfulness meditation.
That's cool. No, I love that. And I've been a fan of loving kindness meditation for a while. And I totally agree with that. And it's so much easier to come back to. It almost like, I wouldn't call it addicting, but it definitely is like habit forming because you feel so good, you know?
Exactly.
And it like builds trust with other people and you don't even like, they don't even have to know that you did it, you know, but you still get the benefit from it. And it's just, and it's so good for your body and your brain. Anyways, so I'm a huge fan of loving kindness meditation. I love that you call it connection meditation. That's really cool.
Yeah. And it's mostly just because I, you know, coming into a workplace, the word love is hard for a lot of people to be able to say.
It's a little woo woo.
Yeah. You know, and it just gets, it can get, you know, and it can get into touchies and, you know, other stuff. So, I just call it a connection meditation, but it's adapted pretty directly from that history.
No, that's so beautiful. So, and I love that as a kind of a solution to how we can socially connect, you know, and feel that social connection, even in the midst of all this. We can start that right now, you know, and you said it's easier to kind of hardwire that and to kind of form this habit for that kind of meditation. So, you talk about this kind of this hardwiring behaviors a lot in your book. I'd love to have you maybe go into that a little bit. Like how do we hardwire some of these behaviors that we actually want,
I think it's
of happiness.
What's really important when we're talking about long-term change in organization, right? Because when I come into organizations, like people get super excited. You know, I do a workshop or do a talk and people are all excited and they, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And they go and they do these things and they feel good for a little while. But then guess what? Life gets busy. The deadlines come and we were going to be doing something like that. Weren't we doing some happiness stuff? Oh, I forget what it was. And now I'm too busy. Right. And so what you really have to do is look and figure out, how do we integrate some of these practices into our workday? How do we make them part of how we do our work instead of some separate happiness thing? Right. So with the personal habits we've just talked about, right? With the connection meditation or with gratitude, you find a few minutes and you make a time to do it. But with work, we need to bring other people along quite often. So there's a whole series of habits I talk about in the book that are A, personal, but also B, there's one-on-one habits. Like when we're interacting one-on-one with somebody, what are some habits we can bring? And then what are some habits we can do as a group? And so a lot of these suggestions come around meetings, around gatherings, around times that we're interacting with each other. So let's take the social connection one again, but let's now talk about one-on-one and habits. So one of my favorite one-on-one habits for social connection is start each of your meetings, your one-on-ones, with a simple question. Hey, what's something awesome you've seen someone on the team do this last week? Right? Simple question. And you can't let them off the hook, right? Oh, I can't think of anything. Oh, okay, but that's all right. Let's wait. Like you got a minute. Think of something, anything. It doesn't have to be great. It doesn't have to be amazing. It doesn't have to be world-changing. But what was something good that you saw someone do? It can even be part of their job, but they did it well, right?
Yeah.
And so what this does, if you do it once, fine. But if you actually make it a habit and you start that meeting every week with the same question, not only is it going to kick off after the first couple times when people are getting used to it, then it's going to kick it off with something positive, right? We're sharing what good things our teammates have done. Awesome. Starts the meeting off great. Also, it's going to give that person, as they're going through their weeks, let's say you do it 2 or 3 weeks in a row, then they're going to be like, oh, you know what? Eric's going to ask me that question again. Sarah just did that nice thing for me. That's the thing I'm going to use, right? And they start scanning the world for what thing they're going to bring to you. And now they're looking for the good. And so you've rewired their brain to start looking for that, especially if you're consistent about it. And also for you as a leader manager, now you've got this long list. If you're doing this with 5 or 6 people every week, you're going to get an ongoing list of all these cool things that then you can go share and share these positive ideas with others. You can say, hey, John said you did a great job, like just helping him with that little presentation. You really tweaked that image in a way that really helped people understand it. You know, whatever it is, you've now got a treasure trove of positive things that you can share and bring.
Well, and it's like self-reinforcing too. You know, it's like when you are about to go work on another project or, you know, starting to the next day, you think about that, right? You think about the time where, oh yeah, they appreciated that, you know? And so it reinforces it. And then there's like that positive ripple effect, right? Like when you you know, when you say that thing about them, that's so nice. Like they're automatically like happier and feeling that positive emotion. And then, you know, they bring that home to their, you know, their family. And then, that ripples to them, and then their family ripple to other people. And then those, you know, I mean, you never know how far it'll go, which is, is amazing.
And just like Sean Aker has done some interesting research. I think it was at LinkedIn where, you know, each additional bit of appreciation that you gave to others, it multiplied multifold in them sharing it with their colleagues and coworkers.
That's so cool. So cool.
Every little bit of appreciation then multiplies. And now you're hardwiring a culture of really authentic appreciation. And that's hugely important.
It's so important. Yeah, seriously. No, it's a powerful, powerful principle. So I want to talk a little bit about another thing you mentioned in the book, which is stress and negativity, though. This was surprising to me a little bit. I mean, not totally, but it was I guess intriguing. You talk about these as tools, right? In this book about happiness. So, you know, so let's talk about, you know, how can negativity and stress be tools, right? And have this impact on our happiness.
Yeah. I think one of the most important things, one of the problems I had when I first found positive psychology was like, this is so cool. I'm never going to have to feel angry or sad or disappointed again. This is going to be awesome. I'll just pull out my tool set. Right. And that actually kept me in the sort of, even though I was talking about happiness, I returned to this place of anxiety and insomnia and depression, because you can't. And the fact is, if we're going to live and we're going to love in this world, hard things are going to happen. And we need to, so on the negative emotion side, we need to let in, I like to, Barbara Fredrickson first separated out the idea of necessary negative emotions and gratuitous negative emotions. Mm. Necessary are the ones that we need, like they're real things, real, like, yes, it sucks that we've had to be trapped largely in our homes and not being able to do a lot of the things we want. That's legitimately hard. So it's totally okay to be sad about that and to be frustrated about that. Like if you don't get picked for a team or for a special project that you were looking forward to or promotion, like that genuinely sucks. And yeah. You need to be able to open up to that and not cover it over or pretend it doesn't matter. You need to let it in, give it some space to be felt. Maybe it's some journaling, maybe it's something, but you need to face it, not pretend it didn't happen. And then there's lots of gratuitous stuff. Like I didn't get picked. That means that they don't like me, that I'm never going to get a promotion, that I'm going to end, they're going to end up firing me. I'm going to be homeless. I'm going to be like catastrophization and all these other things. Right. And we do this in our head. That's gratuitous negative emotion. There's a whole set of tools in the book for how to work through it, right? And this is much more classic psychology and therapy kind of work, like cognitive behavioral stuff. What are things that we can do to change those thought patterns? And I think that's important. Now, stress is its own game. We have time. I want to spend a few minutes on this because I think it is counterintuitive. You know, stress is given such a bad rap in our society. Like everywhere we look, we hear about how stress is destroying our productivity and killing us, right?
Right.
But stress evolved to help us. We didn't evolve it so that it would be terrible for us. We evolved it because when we're stressed, our heart starts to beat faster. Our breathing increases and our body releases all this energy and glucose and fats into our bloodstream. All of those things are to get us ready to act, ready to move forward. And recent research has uncovered some really powerful ways that we can harness the energy of stress in order to meet the challenges we face. Here's the challenge. Here's the problem. Like we think of the stress response as sort of one thing, but the stress response is at a continuum. On one end is the traditional, what we call the, what researchers call the threat response. This is the one we hear so much about. We don't believe we have the resources to meet the challenges in front of us. In that case, blood is shunted away from the more evolved parts of our brain and inhibits our ability to think clearly. And we become very reactive, very automatic. And oftentimes that means sort of running away from the stress, right? Or whatever is stressing us. We distract ourselves, we procrastinate. And then on the health side, like we're also retracting blood from the periphery, our legs and our arms and other parts. And that's causing, that causes the high blood pressure and a lot of the health problems associated with stress. So that's the threat side. But on the opposite end of the still stress response, still when we're feeling stress, we can have a response called the challenge response. And this occurs when we recognize it's going to be hard. Wow, I didn't expect to have to do this. But we have, we know that we have the confidence and some of the resources to, if not solve the problem, at least start addressing it and start moving towards a better place. And what's really interesting is this response has a totally different set of body processes. It actually opens up the peripheral vasculature in your brain and your body, which provides more energy and oxygen so you can process information better. You can see the big picture better, and you can actually choose what you want to do instead of sort of reacting. And while our heart is still beating fast, the open vessels sort of drive our blood pressure down, which is a much healthier state. So the question then is, how do we move away from the threat response and towards the challenge response? And that is, there's several things that I want to touch on quickly because I hate giving the problem and not the answer.
No, this is fascinating.
So one of the biggest strategies is you have to shift your mindset. Like simply recognizing that stress can be helpful. Not that it always is, but that it can be helpful changes how you respond to it. If you look at Ali Crum, is a great researcher out of Stanford, Jeremy Jameson out of University of New York, they both have done some amazing work just showing that if you teach people, have them read an article, have them go through a little workshop, anything that just shows that's how stress can be helpful, and you tell them about how stress can be helpful, it often becomes helpful. That by shifting our mindset, it shifts us to this challenge end of the response because we're looking for ways for it to benefit us. Oh, my heart's beating fast. That doesn't mean it's a terrible thing that I'm stressed and that I'm going to do terribly. What it means is that's giving me the energy to actually go towards the challenge and meet the challenge. So in study after study, and they did some studies at LinkedIn, they did some studies at some big investment banks. They did studies with people getting ready for the GRE, getting ready for a speaking opportunity, that if you just let them know, remind them that stress can be helpful, it becomes helpful. So that's my favorite because it's just like, yeah, oh my God, that's so cool.
It's like,
and it becomes more healthy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's completely mindset. And that's, you know, where Ali Crum actually did some of her early work. The second one is meaning and stress are really tied tightly together. Kelly McGonigal, who's written a whole book in this space, talks about the stress paradox. We only stress about things we care about. So that's what's interesting. There's a couple big things that are interesting here. One is, so when you're feeling stressed, go in, what is meaningful about this? About whatever's happening. Why am I feeling this stress? Because there's something really important there. And if you focus not on this stress and this immediate thing, but why is this thing important to me? Why is it important that I do well with this? And just by visiting the purpose, the reason that this is important to you, can help you move to the challenge response. And the second thing is we can be more accepting of stress when it comes, if we're doing something big. Ali, again, says, she uses a metaphor. It's a cold, dark night on the side of Everest. And I love this because you're like, I'm climbing the tallest mountain in the world. Of course, it's going to be hard. Not everybody can do this. There's no oxygen up here. It's cold. There's going to be a lot of cold, dark nights. But it's because I'm willing to invest those challenging times, that stress, because I'm going to do something that very few people have done in the world. And that's the same thing when you're talking about anything, raising children, when you're talking about building a strong relationship with a partner, when you're talking about some work project that is really important to you. There's going to be stress that comes with those things. It's well documented. All of those things have lots of stress. So don't be shocked when it comes. Don't take it as a lesson that, oh, we should be doing something different. I should give up on this partner because she's stressing me out. No, stressing you out because this person's important to you. and you want you want things to go better than they are, so you need to change. And so anyway, that's the purpose one. And then the final one I'll just take quickly is, when we are really stressed, we go into the threat response when we don't feel we have the resources to address it. So when you do, when you start feeling that threat response come on, just step back, take a breath and say, okay, this is not something I was planning for, or maybe it is, and it's, but now it's here. And I need to figure this out. What are all the resources I have? When have I faced a problem like this before? When have, what strengths do I have that I could bring to it? Who are the people around me that have maybe done something like this before, or maybe have some ideas, right? Who can I hire? Who can I call that might be able to help me? Just by inventorying all the people around you and the things that you can do can bring you again to that challenge response, because you're looking, you're now realizing that you have more resources than you thought in that split second when you first heard about whatever that stressor was. So anyway, that was a lot.
No, that's so good. I was just like taking notes. This is amazing. And I'm glad, because this is like a whole section in your book where you talk about this. So it's just, this is something that I think is so valuable for people. I was just talking to a friend last week, and he was just terrified because I think his doctor or somebody told him, you know, your stress is like killing you, basically. You know, and if you don't reduce stress, like this is gonna, you know, take you down physically pretty quickly. And so, you know, he was really concerned about it.
We fear the stress, right?
Right.
And that adds more stress. You're doing the exact opposite of what you want.
Right. Yeah. Yes, you have to like break that cycle. Stress,
you do.
Yeah. And I love these examples of how to break the cycle, you know, the challenge, go into that challenge mode versus the threat mode. And it's just, it's a powerful tool. It's a powerful skill. I think we have to practice it though. Right. I mean, it's absolutely, like you really have to practice. So,
and that's a big part of, you know, just like we talked about hardwiring anything, we need to find a way to practice it. And what I recommend for everybody is that they go through the Aspire program, is what I sort of call it. It's just an acronym for shifting mindset and purpose. Especially when you're planning, right? When you're doing your daily planning, your weekly planning, your monthly planning, look at where you think those stress parts are going to come proactively ahead of time. Hey, why is this stressful for me? Let's log the meaning. What's the purpose here? And I know that when I'm stressed, it's going to help me get to the goals. It's going to help me face those challenges directly instead of distracting or putting it off, which of course then is just going to make it more and more stressful because you're not even moving towards it. So that's the one of the biggest habits that I think can really help people is go through it regularly. And then as soon as you start feeling some stress, all right, what is the mindset thing that I can bring here? What's the meaning piece that's here? What's the resource piece that's here? How can I reach out to others? Which is one of the other tools, is how can I help other people solve their problems? And then it's going to give me some courage to come back and help solve my own.
Such good stuff. I mean, this is so good. So thank you for sharing this. I think it's empowering to people. I mean, the goal of this podcast, right, is to help people to trigger upward spirals of health and happiness. And this is exactly what, I mean, these are golden nuggets. So thank you for mining those for us.
Absolutely. It's so nice to be in a place where, you know, having done this work for so long, just as you have, to know that you've got these sets of nuggets that people just aren't making those changes. And so I think the most important thing is you don't have to do all these things.
Right.
Pick one or two things that from the research, something, I mean, I call this book the action buffet, that I've got dozens of exercises, dozens of ideas and dozens of habits. You don't have to do them all. Read through them, find ones that sound interesting and intriguing to you personally, or that you think would work well with your team. And then take a couple of bites of that, like scoop a little bit on your plate, bring it to your team, try it out for a few times. And if it doesn't work, that's okay. Go back to the buffet and get something else. If it does though, now take a big helping and figure out, how do we integrate it into how we do our work every day? How do we make it a regular part of what we do instead of a special, oh, let's do a happiness thing now. Okay, that was fun. Back to work. No, how do we spend a couple minutes here, a couple minutes there, planting seeds for positive emotions?
That's a beautiful analogy. I love it.
Yeah. We got to create space for it if it's not going to happen. It's no guarantee that we're every time we do these exercises, we're all going to be bouncing around the room super happy. No, that's not going to, we can't hold on to that. But if we create space for it, plant seeds for it, then oftentimes it's going to happen. And that's what matters. All we need to do is have a few more times a day that we feel some small, even some small positive emotions. That's what makes a big difference. Not the giant, I had a baby and I'm so happy, or I got a promotion and I'm so happy. Those are great. We love those, but it's the small little connections we made with somebody, the small little sets of appreciation we get, the small little connections, the small little using our strength, you know, those are the things that are really what we're talking about. Not the big, big ones.
Right. No, it's beautiful. I love it. And I'd love to you know, push you a little further. This is a question that I actually ask all my guests. And I mean, we've been talking about happiness a lot throughout this whole episode, but I'd love to have you, you know, just give some advice, share some any other advice that you have, for listeners who just really are seeking a more happy life today.
Yeah. Don't try to do it all at once. Don't wait until you have a big chunk of time to do this. Buy a couple of the books. Buy my book if you want, great. But if there's some other happiness book that fits who you are and what you want to do, get it. You don't have to read the whole book. Flip through and pick a chapter and find out what some of those exercises are. Just do one thing. We don't have to change everything. Do one thing. Find a couple minutes to start a happiness habit, to start a gratitude practice, to start this connection meditation we talked about. Just whatever it is, pick something and then just do it consistently each day for some period of time. Don't wait. So many people are waiting during this pandemic. Oh, well, once we get back to life the way it is, then I'll start focusing on my happiness again. Then I'll start focusing on work again. Then, we need to stop. We need to just do and be.
I love that. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. That was beautiful. So Eric, because I think people should buy your book. So where can they find your book? Where can they find you, follow you, support your work, all those things?
Yeah. So first, if they go to puthappinesstowork.com, puthappinesstowork.com, there's a little bit more information about the book, but mostly it gets you to the links of whatever retailer you want to buy it from, if it's Amazon or whatever else, or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million, they're all there. So that's the easiest way. And I'm actually offering a free workshop participation for anyone that pre-orders the book or buys the book in this first couple months of the launch. So nice. There's an incentive to kind of do it. And that workshop, it's an hour-long workshop, interactive. We're gonna dig deep into some of the issues on some of the lessons of the book, and then I'm really active on LinkedIn, becoming more active and getting followers on Twitter now. Both of those are at Eric Karpinski, so Eric is with a C, and then Karpinski is with a K, and so they can find it that way. Find me that way. And I think you do a pretty good job of sharing those links on
on
your website as well.
Yep. Yes. Thank you. That's perfect. And thank you so much, Eric. I really appreciate your time today. And I know the listeners will as well. So thanks for being here.
Absolutely, Andy. It was great to talk.
I really hope this episode helped you to have a more happy life today. If you enjoy this episode, share it and let me know by tapping the stars in the reviews. You can also find me on Instagram @morehappylife or by going to morehappylife.co. Thanks for listening and see you soon.